First of all, thanks to Barbara and Alex for inviting me here to give this talk. And if Andy said he is a part-time intermediate depth earthquake studying person, I think we are more like junkies on this. We work on this for a couple of years and then let it rest for 10 years, and then we start working on it again. So what I want to present here is really a work which was mainly done by my graduate students. And Sebastian Martin was actually my first graduate student when I was still at the University of Potsdam. Then Tom Gars came into play a few years ago, and Sophie Coulson, she was a master student just a couple of years in my final years at Liverpool. So what are we doing? So yesterday, we did see a lot of these images looking at the Vadati-Benioff zone seismicity, and we all know the double Vadati-Benioff zone in Japan, and our work was really influenced by the work of Kirby in this famous book, Subduction Top to the Bottom, where he came up with this idea of dehydration embrittlement. And if you look at the sketch, and I will come back to the sketch quite often in my talk, there's a lot in there. So he is proposing, or has proposed, that we have these hydrated faults. Then he has proposed that there are metamorphic reactions and they are linked to intermediate depth seismicity. He has proposed that this is gradually going and cutting in into the oceanic crust, and that at one stage we have eclogite down here. So what we want to do and what we want to look at is really, how can we image this? Is there any way that we actually can find out the seismic velocities of these structures? Because if you take this as face values, here we have basaltic oceanic crust, so it should be low velocity in comparison to the surrounding. And then if it goes to eclogite, it should be nearly mantle velocities. And up to now, it's really, really hard to image this kind of detail. And that is what we want to look at in the next 30 minutes. I also put in this slide because Alex was asking yesterday about the structure of intermediate depth seismicity in northern Chile. So we are here in northern Chile. So that is Chile, Bolivia, the Altiplano region. Here's Argentina with the Puna region. And you see here this blob of intermediate depth seismicity that at that time, at the early 2000s, it was the first time we could really image it because we had networks out there. Before that, it was really, really sparse. And yesterday, we did see the famous figure of Sippel et al., where he still has this blob. If you do a much better job in relocating these earthquakes, and we could do this because we also had stations in Bolivia, what you actually can do is you see a double seismic zone in northern Chile. And here is the histogram. So you see two clear peaks with a separation of about 10 kilometers. So there is clear evidence that there is a double seismic zone in that region. We then started to look a little bit more into detail here. So we proposed also already at the time the ceiling at the top. We had hydrated oceanic mantle. And if you are a little bit imaginative, maybe these are normal faults cutting between the upper layer of seismicity in the oceanic crust down to the seismicity, which really has to be in the subducting mantle, because we know from refraction experiments that the thickness of the oceanic crust, which is going in there, is about 7 to 8 kilometers. So a separation of 10 kilometers really means these events already are happening in the downgoing slab. Then we did see the paper of Brzezinski from 2007, where he really looked at this double seismic zone on a global context. So he studied not only the South American subduction zone, Isobonian, Japan, Kuriles, all of them. And we did see yesterday already, okay, what you can see is if you're plotting here H of the subduction zone, and the separation between the upper plane of seismicity and the lower plane of seismicity, you get this dependence with H. And they proposed that this is actually Antigerite out, which is controlling this reaction. And this can explain the double Vadati-Benioff zone. Then the papers of Facenda came in 2009 and 2012. Where he really invoked this idea that from the seismic refraction data from Cesar Granero, where he proposed that you have deep penetrating faults at the outer rise. Now Jason calls them bent faults. They are initiated here at the outer rise, and due to the unbending of the slab, you are actually pumping the water down deeper into the mantle. And that can explain then the deep penetration of hydrous minerals down to greater depths, and in a newer paper then he could also somehow explain this lower zone of seismicity at depths which are comparing or comparable to what we observe. So let's go back. So actually, in 1996, Kirby really well predicted most of these things. Or you can phrase it around, maybe we were all looking exactly for this in all our data because we were somehow biased by this picture. So how can we image this? How can we really see what is going on? Can we image the seismic properties in the slab? And I don't want to be somehow putting down all the global tomography work, but to find resolution in a layer which is 10 kilometers thick or even thinner might be still pushing it without actually saying anything against Barbara or her co-workers. So what I did is I looked a little bit around, and we were also dragged then much more into tomography, doing tomography at the megathrust. And here is, I think, the perfect example for data sets we nowadays have. This is for the Tohoku-Oki region. You have all the HiNet stations, thousands of short period stations, long period stations. You have really hundreds of OBS deployments. And you have also thousands to 10,000s of earthquakes. How good do you do with current technology? And I think the authors are really, really doing a very honest job when they are plotting the seismic properties along the interface here, where they state, actually, we take -5 + 5 kilometers around the interface, averaging this out. And this is somehow the seismic properties on the interface. That is where you are with local tomography. When you have really good data sets, what is state of the art? We did a little bit of a similar thing. So this is not only in Japan. So in 2010, the Maule earthquake happened. And it was a huge international collaboration to quickly install 200 stations in the region. So it's not 1,000 stations like in Japan, but at least it is one of the best now observed aftershock sequence that we have. We selected 670 events, 38,000 P waves, 14,000 S waves, a lot more of automatic picks involved in this. And these are the 2D cross sections. And of course, we are very proud of them and we publish them. But if you really look at the fine detail in the oceanic crust and the underlying mantle, and here, for example, the VPVS ratio is shown, yes, we do see an oceanic crust with elevated VPVS ratio. We are pretty confident that this elevated VPVS ratio is at least stopping or getting very, very small at about 50 kilometer depths. And it has about the thickness of 10 kilometers, 8 kilometers of the downgoing oceanic crust. But to be honest, we can't resolve any details in there, any velocity structure in there, anything what would propose, even for these really good data sets, that you can resolve something like a phase transition where you can see the phase transition really cutting into the slab from the top of the slab into the oceanic crust. There's, just to summarize this, current experiments and technology based on travel times, and that's really, I think, a very important point here. This is all based on travel times. The structures in the oceanic crust are hard to resolve. Or you can say we can't resolve them even for the shallow data sets. If we're now going to 200 or 300 kilometers, I don't want to do the same analysis. I don't think we can say we can resolve this. a different approach here, and that is a very good paper of Peter here, is they are using an inferred top of the slab from receiver functions, for example. They are then plotting the seismicity in here. And what you can see here is this separation between top of the slab and the seismicity going into the slab. And if you then do thermal models, then you can associate this with the interpretation based on PT, that this is the metamorphic reaction of blue schist out, and that then the seismicity is dying off. It's still not confirming what are the velocities here. It's still not confirming that this top of the slab is really at the right location, that the seismicity is really at the right location, because we are looking actually straight down. And anybody who has done tomography, if your ray passes are all parallel, things are getting very complicated to resolve the average velocities and velocity contrasts with depths. So travel times or receiver function imaging are difficult. So let's go back. I think we have to find somehow techniques that we can image this, that we have a better control where the earthquakes are and where the structures in the downgoing slabs are. And luckily, what we can do is not only use travel times, let's look at the full waveforms. And for us, that was really something like a very cool paper in 2000 by Jeff Abers, because, and I show it later, he did see and interpret these kind of waveforms. So you have a low frequency arrival from events which are very deep in the subducting zone, or in his case, have traveled quite a long way in the slab and then reached the station, in comparison to events which are much closer, much shallower, which only see a non-dispersed arrival. So that was his observation, and he explained this as hydrated subducted crust at 100 to 250 kilometer depths. And the physical interpretation of this was we have a waveguide, which is promoting these low frequencies traveling through, and we can really see this dispersed waveform here very nicely, that low frequencies are coming first and high frequencies are coming later. So that was his observation. His modeling was a little bit, well, we couldn't do it much better at that time, because if you have a waveguide, and everybody knows this optic fiber cable, so if you put the energy in at one point, it will not leave it. So if you have the wave traveling in this waveguide, it's nice that it is in there and will have this dispersed behavior, but how on earth do we observe it at the surface? We don't have a seismometer at 100 kilometer depths to really see what is going on. So that was actually the questions we were asking ourselves once we looked at our own data sets that we collected in the late 90s. And this is an example that we did find. So this is, again, the northern Chile, Bolivia, and Argentina. The station here is AER, and we also found it as CHG. And what did we find? For events at 80 kilometer depths, it's a high frequency impulse. For events which are at 200 kilometer depths, we had this low frequency arrival following by high frequencies. So we were there and thinking, okay, what can we do? Can we start to really understand the physics about this wave propagation so that we can try to use these observations to infer the small-scale structure in the slab? So we looked further and we compiled a data set, and that was all published then. And here is the waveforms at station AER at low at small depths, 80 to 110 kilometers, we only have high frequency arrivals. And if you look at the spectrum here, it has a peak about 8 to 10 hertz. If you go deeper with your focal depths, you nicely see how this low frequency arrival is developing with depths. And what you can then see in the spectrum is that the energy is really taken over by this low frequency peak around 2 hertz. So at small depths, around 100, it's high frequencies. At greater depths, we really have a lot of concentration of the energy at low frequencies. So we then started a little bit doing finite difference modeling, because the computers were just there, that we can actually look into these cross sections and try to decipher what is really going in terms of wave phenomena. So we started very naive, and the figures are not great, but I can talk you through. So we just have a crust layer here, about 50 to 60 kilometers, that we know is there in the central Andes. We have the continental mantle here with a velocity of 8.1. We have our waveguide in here, and we have the subducting mantle. And we put the earthquake close into the waveguide, put our receivers at exactly the distances we observe, and we were very depressed because we didn't see any guided waves leaking out coming to our stations. So we thought, okay, this model is too simplistic. Let's open this up with some sediments that are being subducted. And then we thought this is something like a fan, and the low frequency arrival that we would observe if we would put a receiver here at 100 kilometer depth, which would be great, we can't see it at our surface array. So at that time, Sebastian was already doing his PhD for 1.5 years, and we thought, that is getting now tricky. What can we do? Luckily, at one stage, we said, come on, we have the really well relocated seismicity for the first time now here in northern Chile. Just use this geometry, which is more or less a straight line, but it has a bend in here. And that is shown here. So we just fitted straight lines to this with a bend here, which is then really at the right locations. And in gray here, it is shown the array or the stations where we observe this low frequency arrival, and we could see it. So the explanation why we can observe these guided waves at the surface is just leaking of the wave field out here. I want to show this with some snapshots of the wave field. So here it is straight. It's a low velocity layer in here. So here's the earthquake. And you can see in a straight line subduction zone, the energy is building up in the waveguide. It's the trapped waves. They are not attenuated. They are traveling up, geometrically attenuated. If you then put this bend in here, what is happening is this highly polarized wave field in the low velocity layer, it has just one wave number, it hits this bend, so part of the energy gets reflected or refracted out and is traveling then up to our observation points up here. And that is the reason why we can observe these guided wave arrivals and why we can use them to study actually the small scale structure of the subducting slab. But it also means we have to put our stations really in the straight line up down, going down here, because it's a very focused arrival which you only can observe in a certain direction of the downgoing slab. So, the other thing I want to bring home in this talk is also earthquake location matters. And everybody who has worked with fiber optic cables does know this. So here is when our earthquake is located more or less at the boundary of the low velocity layer and the downgoing mantle or whatever it is, the high velocity here, and we see very nice dispersed waveforms with low frequencies arriving first. If the source is above or below, and that means we look at this a little bit more, in the order of half of the thickness of the waveguide, then you do not excite these waveforms. They will not just couple in, and you will not see the characteristic dispersion. Also, source radiation matters. So we also looked at this then, And for down dip extension, what you can see here, and this is somehow to compress all the information. So let's go back to these spectrums. These were the events above 100 kilometers. These were the events with focal depths greater than 140 kilometers. And the solid line, that is the low frequency arrival in the synthetic waveforms, the dashed line is the high frequency. And it's here amplitude. So for down dip extension events, which is here the angle we give 22.5 degrees, you can see or you can excite them if your source is located beneath here for 45 degrees, one or two wavelengths, no, thickness of the layer beneath and in the middle of it. So it's very, very critical where the actual position of the source is. So we can not only study the fine scale structure of the slab, it also tells us something about the relative locations of the event to this low velocity guide. So we did all this. This is something like a summary figure for this area in northern Chile. Here again, it's source depths going down. This is the data trace, and that is the simulation. And for a big stretch of source depths from 100 to 250 kilometers, we could actually model at that time with the limited resources of computational power, we could model these observed waveforms pretty well. So what were our conclusions? 4.5 kilometers thick, low velocity layer down to at least 160 to 180 kilometers. A velocity reduction of about 7%, and earthquakes are located inside or just below the low velocity layer. So this is where we left it in 2006. Because I, at that time, have moved to England, I couldn't find any suitable HPC computation. So to really move on, we needed more computing power. We needed more ability to calculate many more wave fields in a faster time to really do and add something to this problem. Then, in 2012, Tom Garth started with me as a graduate student. And at that time, actually, I must be very... Somebody came to me and said, actually, do you know there's computing time on Archer available? Do you want to use it? And I said, yes, of course. I still have this unsolved problem. Let's do something. And luckily, and that is very lucky, in the UK, I also had a very capable graduate student at the same time, so we could actually start tackling this problem again. So what I show here is now, since we did study Chile before, we looked at Hokkaido in Japan. Here is the profile of the stations, and you see the waveform here. That is for this event at about 200 kilometer depths. And you see on the profile, as I've shown before, for these two stations, they are really in the angle where the low frequency arrival should come up. You see this low frequency arrival. And here's just a plot to compare the low frequency part with the high frequency part of the waveform. And you see the clear dispersion at these two stations, really at the edge of Hokkaido. So for these events, A, B, C, okay, we can say maybe they are located very closely to the top of the slab. So let's do the same calculations that we have done in Chile. And here are the waveforms for it, or the snapshots of the wave field. So here's the earthquake source, propagating upward, leaking out. And that gives us an idea of the structure of this low velocity structure. And what we found for Japan is thickness of low velocity layer is about 8 kilometers, and velocities are 7.2 to 7.5 kilometers per second. Clear dependence with depths. So we see the lower velocities for the shallower earthquakes and the higher velocities for the deeper velocities. And we can actually model it with something where the velocity is smoothly increasing with depths in the low velocity layer. However, Tom did a really excellent job because he also looked at all the events which are happening here. And for all the red dots, what could he see? He also found this low frequency arrival. And that was completely puzzling because we said in our previous papers, and he came to me and I said, no, that can't be true. Go back, do it again. No, he was very persistent, and I'm really happy he was. So he looked at this and he found these low frequency arrivals. So how can we get the energy now to our stations? And we tried a lot, and luckily there was enough computing power on Archer, so we could play around a lot. And then we looked at one stage, we looked at the outer, at the oceanic crust before it enters into the subducting trench. And you can see here already these parallel bend folds. So somehow we went back to these ideas. You have to have maybe deeply hydrated folds reaching into the mantle, which could act as low velocity serpentinized mantle, which then might help our course. So what he did is then came up with this very simplistic model. And we don't think that the subducting slab looks like this, but it's just a model which helps us to understand physically what is going on with the wave propagation. So we are looking now at the wave field here from an event which is far away from the thick low velocity layer, but happening inside one of these deeply serpentinized folds. And you can see here the fit to the waveform, the fit to the dispersion curve, it matches. So the energy gets trapped here, and part of it is then traveling upwards to our stations. And that was more or less the only explanation we could find to image this. So then we thought, okay, this is far too simplistic. The Earth is not regular like this, so that you have a fold every 10 kilometers. So here on this side, we just looked at the high-frequency arrivals, so high-pass filtering our observed waveforms. And what you can see is that actually the waveform gets elongated as further as you go along here. And we thought, oh, this is a typical example of a scattering wave field. If you look at these moonquakes, they have codas which are reaching on for 10 to 20 minutes. So let's model this. And this is done here with a von Karman model. And the explanation that we put forward is shown here. So we have this low velocity layer on the top. We have the earthquakes here, which are or have to happen on these serpentinized deep reaching folds. But here now we have a random model to model the coda. And by doing this, we can then start to estimate actually how much water is bound in this downgoing slab and in the mantle part, which was not possible before. All the work done before was looking at the water content going down with the sediments or maybe with the oceanic crust. And we came up with these numbers. So we need 70 to 31% serpentinization, which is then 2 to 3.5% H2O, which has to go down at least 200 kilometers into the mantle. Then we thought, okay, let's go back to Chile. And at that time, now we also have the IPOC network. So, and we have the outer rise faults. We have the spacing of every 10 kilometers of these outer rise faults. And we have these observations where you have the direct arrival here, much nicer here. And then the high frequency is coming later. This is always the low frequency. That is just the high frequency part of the seismograms. And we have a lot more of observations. Then we did the same modeling in this case, but now looking at the Nazca plate, which is much younger in age, only 45 million years. Same thing, same modeling technique. And we are explaining our dispersion curves, and we are even explaining the first 2-3 seconds of our seismograms with a frequency bandwidth going up to about 10 hertz here. Then let's go back. Let's look at this model. So what you need to actually parameterize this are four parameters. One is the thickness of the low velocity layer on the top, the velocity reduction of this, the spacing of the folds in the mantle, and how thick these folds are. So four parameters. And this is shown here. So we did then a very extensive grid search. And then at one time, people said, no, you can't use so much time anymore on Archer. But we were lucky to nearly get everything through. So what you're seeing here is the low velocity layer thickness and the low velocity, velocity on these two axes. And inside, it's always variation of the fold spacing and the fold widths. And the best parameters with a minimum misfit are these blue dots. So somewhere around here, with a low velocity layer thickness of 1 to 2 kilometers, a spacing of the folds between 5 and 10 kilometers, and a width of these serpentinized folds of 1 kilometer. That gave us the best observation. And from this, we can then say in the central Andes, 45 million year old slab, we have about 5 to 15% of serpentinization. So much less than in the cold slab, but I think that is also expected just from the temperature model. So how can we somehow try to interpret this on a petrological sense? And I expect to get a lot of stick for this. I already got a lot of it. So here are the summary of our interpretation for this low velocity layer on the top, which is part of the oceanic crust and has velocities of about 7.3, on average 7.4. And that is the observation. So we can't argue directly with this observation. If we want to interpret this in terms of the mineral composition, we would be in the jadeite lawsonized blue schist phase. But, and that is a big, big but, at temperatures and pressures where it should not exist. So at these temperatures and pressures, we would be here, that we have in the eglogite phase, but then we would not see a low velocity layer whatsoever. So that is the first observation just for this low velocity layer. Then if you're looking into the mantle, and that is here then the approximation of how much bound and hydrated fold water is going down in these bent folds. So if you do the rough calculation for Japan, it's about 170 to 318 teragram per million years per meter subduction zone. If you add this up over the whole subduction zone with similar age, you come up with about 3.5 oceans over the age of the Earth being recycled into the mantle. If you do this for a much younger slab, you come up with 13 to 42 teragram per million years, which then, because the thickness of this layer is much lower, I think it's about 1 ocean which is getting recycled. So it's 3.5 plus 1, and then you have to think, what are all other subduction zones doing? And so our statement here is really that an order of magnitude of water is going down into the mantle more than we have thought before, and just by estimating and looking at crustal rocks. There's a lot which is going down. And that leads me to the conclusions. I hope I could convince you that this crustal low velocity layer is there. We can model it, and our best interpretation right now is metastability is needed, really down to great depths. Serpentinized folds in the mantle are the main source of water input deeper into the mantle, so forget all the crustal rocks. They are just tiny in comparison to what is going down in the mantle. And we also have a paper out now where we do this for Alaska. It's a GIL paper, so we're still working on this and trying to get a global image of this soon. Thank you.